Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 16th, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week shows an army tank. It's driven into a ditch. It's kind of banged up. The top is open, and you see the head and torso of Vladimir Putin. He's looking up at the sky, quite concerned. There's drones flying all around. The headline is Putin's Last Stand. What's at stake in Ukraine's major counteroffensive? That is our first main story. We will start with that. Ukraine probes for holes in Russia's defenses. What happened? Ukraine began exploratory attacks on Russian lines this week in the first phase of its long-awaited counteroffensive, even as the collapse of a hydroelectric dam in Russia-occupied southern Ukraine inflicted a fresh humanitarian crisis. Ukrainian forces staged a series of artillery strikes and ground attacks along the Eastern Front in the southeastern Donetsk region, which U.S. and NATO officials cast as an effort to probe for Russian weaknesses in advance of a larger assault. It is widely expected that the counteroffensive will aim to break through Russian lines, drive to the Sea of Azov coast, and sever the land bridge connecting Russian-occupied Crimea with the Russian mainland. That would cut Russia's occupying forces in two. Russia said the counteroffensive was underway, while Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told the Wall Street Journal the moment was at hand. "We are going to do it, and we are ready," he said. The destruction of the massive Nova-Kakhovka Dam, which straddles the Dnipro River, unleashed a reservoir that supplied water for drinking and agriculture to a vast swath of southern Ukraine, and destroyed a hydroelectric plant that supplied power to a population that before the war measured about 3 million. Floodwaters inundated dozens of villages along the river, destroying homes and prompting mass evacuations. Tens of thousands of people face a dire humanitarian situation, said the International Committee of the Red Cross. Russia and Ukraine blamed each other for the destruction, which experts said was likely caused by an explosion set off within the steel and concrete structure. A State Department spokesman noted that it was Russia that was in control of the dam. Zelensky said Russia had detonated a bomb of mass environmental destruction to derail the counteroffensive, but vowed it would not stop Ukraine and Ukrainians. "We will still liberate all our land." What the columnist said. Recent weeks have brought an extraordinary shift in the conflict, said Alexei Kovalev in Foreign Policy. Russia's war has come home to roost. Last week, a residential area of Moscow was attacked by a fleet of drones that damaged at least three buildings, deeply unnerving residents. Things got even more disturbing days later when fighters for Ukraine crossed the border and seized control of villages in Russia's Belgorod region, prompting mass evacuations. These humiliations come at a time when the mood on usually jingoistic state TV talk shows is tilting toward defeatism, and Ukrainians are stepping up their drone attacks on oil refineries, airfields, and other critical sites deep inside Russia. The drone attacks and ground incursions have caused a psychological shift among Russians, said Yaroslav Trofimov in the Wall Street Journal. Russia's elites are rattled, and each new attack strikes a blow to the official narrative of Russian supremacy and a challenge to Putin's image of invincibility. "It would be foolhardy to underestimate the challenges Ukraine faces," said John E. Herbst and Daniel Fried in the Washington Post. "It's easier to defend lines than fight through them. And after a hapless first year, Russian commanders have learned from their mistakes. But with weak spots in the Russian lines, Ukrainian forces have a real chance of severing the land bridge to Crimea. And if they succeed, it could be decisive. It would potentially put Crimea itself in a vulnerable position, humiliating Putin and creating more cracks in his increasingly divided regime. For Putin, the stakes can't be overstated, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. If the counteroffensive drives Russian troops from Ukraine, the resulting geopolitical earthquake will mark the end of the dangerous expansionist Russia that Europe has known and feared since the 18th century. A weakened and discredited Kremlin would be squeezed by a powerful China in the east and a reinvigorated NATO in the west. Meanwhile, a victorious Ukraine would model a Slavic democracy many Russians would want to emulate. The dam's destruction is an ominous sign of what a losing Putin might do, said Jim Garrity in National Review. He may decide that if Russian forces can't hold Ukrainian territory, they should wreck everything in their wake. If that's his mind frame, it raises the risk that rage, frustration, or desperation might drive him to use tactical nuclear weapons on Ukrainian soil. How fitting that Ukraine's counteroffensive comes at the anniversary of the 1944 D-Day landing, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. Just as the Allied offensive shifted the trajectory of World War II, the Ukrainians' assault could turn the tide of the battle for Ukraine. If the counteroffensive drives back the Russians, it stands a chance of forcing Moscow to bargain for the end of its failed invasion. If it fails, it would strike a bitter blow to war-weary Ukrainians and endanger continuing NATO support. Military campaigns are all or nothing, or rarely all or nothing, but this one comes close. Controversy of the week. Artificial intelligence. Could it kill us all? If they're worried, we should be worried, said Greg Moore in the Arizona Republic. Hundreds of artificial intelligence researchers and tech leaders, including Bill Gates and OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, recently signed a one-sentence declaration with a dramatic warning. Mitigating the risk of extinction from AI, they said, should be a global priority alongside other societal scale risks, such as pandemics and nuclear war. A more urgent version of March's open letter calling for a six-month pause in AI research, the statement shows the tech world's mounting anxiety that AI will not only replace millions of human workers, and serve as a tool for bad actors to create and flood us with disinformation, it might just kill us all. This could happen either by accident, as artificial intelligence blindly pursues some other objective, or on purpose. AI having concluded that warring, polluting, carbon-emitting humans pose an existential threat to the planet. This moment feels eerily reminiscent of the early days of the pandemic, said Oliver Darcy in CNN.com. The experts are frantically sounding the alarm while a complacent public goes about its business, unable or unwilling to imagine the unimaginable until it's too late. The difference, of course, is that the COVID pandemic claimed a mere 7 million lives, while a rogue AI could swiftly affect the erasure of the human race from planet Earth. Take this doomerism with a large virtual grain of salt, said Stephen March in The Guardian. Silicon Valley is always overly impressed with its creations. Remember when digital currency was going to replace the banking system? And we would all spend our days inside the metaverse? Algorithms do not have will, and the anthropomorphization of AI is a scheming, malevolent force in science fiction. Actually, AI doomerism is a decoy, said Matteo Wong in The Atlantic. Tech leaders would prefer we worry about some imagined future AI cataclysm than pay attention to how AI-powered products are already surveilling us, collecting our data, coarsening political discourse, and addicting our children to damaging social media. Tell that to Jeffrey Hinton, said Will Knight in Wired. Known as the godfather of AI and a signatory of last week's statement, Hinton, 75, resigned from Google last month after concluding that machines are much closer to taking over than he'd previously realized. AI models can already outreason human beings in many areas and can even hold credible conversations and explain what makes jokes funny, Hinton points out. In 5 to 20 years, he worries AI will be more sophisticated than the human brain. How many examples do you know of a more intelligent thing being controlled by a less intelligent thing, he asked. Given the galloping rate at which these systems are learning, we could find ourselves subordinated sooner rather than later, said Jonathan Friedland in The Guardian. If we want to avoid that fate, we have not a moment to waste. It would help if the doomsayers could lay out a specific path to extinction, said AI scientist Nello Cristiani in The Conversation. A generic sense of alarm doesn't tell us how to regulate and restrict this emerging, awe-inspiring technology, which also will bring mankind enormous benefits. Let's not jettison our sense of proportion. The first step to avoiding worst-case scenarios is to name and describe them, so safeguards can be built into the super smart machines that will inevitably change our lives. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for potty mouths with the announcement from Apple that an update to the iPhone operating system will no longer autocorrect a common swear word to, quote, ducking. It was a good week for believers with reports that David Grush, an Air Force veteran and former U.S. intelligence officer, has filed a whistleblower complaint claiming that federal authorities have recovered numerous intact and partially intact vehicles of non-human origin that have crashed on Earth, including dead aliens. And it was a good week for consistency after a Utah school district banned the Bible in response to a parent's complaint that it discusses fornication and other sensitive material. State Senator Todd Weiler called the ban a fair trade so schools could censor X-rated contents in other books. But it was a bad week for Kim Jong-un after South Korean intelligence reported that the 5'7" North Korean dictator has ballooned to more than 300 pounds and is trapped in a vicious cycle of eating, smoking, and drinking. Kim's father, Kim Jong-il, died of a heart attack in 2011. It was a bad week for bears after Connecticut's legislature voted to let state residents use deadly force if threatened by the wild creatures. The state has seen a rising number of bear attacks, including a black bear's raid on a bakery in which it helped itself to more than 60 cupcakes. Finally, it was a bad week for speeding on a curve after Finnish businessman Anders Wyckoff was fined $129,000 for driving 50 miles per hour in a 30-mile-per-hour zone under Finland's system of progressive fines, which indexes penalties to the driver's income. I really regret this matter, said Wyckoff, who had previously paid tickets of $102,000 and $68,000. The briefing this week is CNN in crisis. Why is CNN struggling? The network is suffering an identity crisis as its owners and newsroom fight over how to cover the GOP and Donald Trump's incendiary 2024 presidential bid. When Trump was in office, ratings soared as CNN departed from conventional news coverage and permitted impassioned commentary from anchors and correspondents in the style of Fox News and MSNBC, such as when CNN's Don Lemon opened a show by declaring, "The President of the United States is a racist." But CNN's ratings have cratered since Trump left office, recently hitting an 8-year low of fewer than 500,000 total daily viewers, less than half of the audience at Fox and MSNBC. In an especially humiliating turn of events, CNN's average primetime ratings dipped below those of right-wing upstart Newsmax, Warner Brothers, Discovery, which acquired CNN last year, wants to win back independent and conservative viewers by featuring more Republicans and prioritizing down-the-middle reporting, promising a return to CNN founder Ted Turner's goal to make news the star. But internal infighting over the goal led this week to the dismissal of the new CEO, Chris Licht, after he made a series of disastrous decisions. What went wrong? Warner Brothers Discovery president David Zaslav hired Licht to shake up the network, saying viewers and advertisers don't want CNN to be an advocacy network. Coverage, Zaslav said, must show both sides of every issue. And he praised the network for interviewing 75 Republicans during January's 4-day battle over whether to elect Kevin McCarthy as the GOP House Speaker. Licht slash costs, laid off more than 300 employees, shut down CNN's new streaming service, and canceled documentary programming such as Stanley Tucci's popular Italy-based food show. Licht also fired journalists known for criticizing Republicans and Fox, notably Brian Stelter, John Harwood, and Jeffrey Toobin, and launched a lighthearted morning show that thus far has been a ratings bust. Lemon was ousted in April after clashing with his co-host and angering co-workers. CNN's rising star, Caitlin Collins, has been named to fill the coveted 9 p.m. slot and was chosen to interview Trump at a recent CNN town hall. How did that go? It was widely deemed a journalistic disaster. Though Collins asked tough, well-informed questions, Trump repeatedly steamrolled over her, reiterating falsehoods and calling her a nasty person as the MAGA-packed audience whooped in approval. Some of CNN's journalists publicly criticized Licht for giving Trump the platform of a live broadcast. "It's hard to see how America was served by the spectacle of lies that aired on CNN," wrote media critic Oliver Darcy in a CNN newsletter that angered Licht. Anchor Christiane Amanpour slammed the event in a Columbia Journalism School commencement address, warning graduates against false equivalency. "Be truthful, but not neutral," she said. Critics said the town hall's lackluster ratings, 3.3 million viewers, fewer than the past six Trump town halls on Fox, underscored the futility of CNN trying to appeal to right-wing viewers. The interview also alienated its progressive viewers, with overall ratings fallings. With morale at CNN reportedly at rock bottom, Licht further angered the staff by cooperating with an incendiary new profile in The Atlantic that depicted him as a Zaslav puppet on a failing mission. How are CNN's competitors doing? Fox News continues to dominate prime time, averaging about 2.2 million viewers, double MSNBC's audience and nearly four times CNN's. All of the top news networks, including CNN, remain extremely profitable thanks to lucrative licensing fees from cable operators. But the median cable news viewer is in his or her 60s, and the rise of cord cutting as Americans opt for streaming over cable has imperiled the network news business model. When Trump was elected in 2016, more than 70% of U.S. households with a TV had a cable or satellite subscription. That share has fallen to below 40%. Do viewers trust CNN? A YouGov/Economist poll found that 40% of Democratic viewers and just 15% of Republicans consider CNN trustworthy. Zaslav says he's unfazed by the persistence of the partisan split, suggesting that CNN's rebrand could take several years. But trust in the media in general is dropping amid intense partisan polarization and cultural conflict. A Reuters Institute report found that many people in the U.S. are avoiding news entirely, with 29% of respondents saying they often feel worn out by the news. As Trump again seeks the 2024 GOP nomination, media critic Jay Rosen said CNN and other mainstream media outlets face a fundamental dilemma. The press, he said, has to decide how to do journalism in the presence of a threat to democracy that permits the journalism we do. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with Latinos who are white supremacists. Latino white supremacy isn't an oxymoron, said Geraldo Cadava. Puzzled media commentary on last month's mass shooting in Allen, Texas, noted the 33-year-old Mexican-American shooter's apparent affinity for white power ideology. His Nazi tattoos, his right-wing death squad patch, and the conspiracist replacement theory rhetoric in his diary. But he wasn't unique. The ranks of white nationalist Latinos today include far-right live streamer Nick Fuentes and Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio. It's a sign of how deeply many of the 60 million Latinos in the U.S. have assimilated. They learned English, intermarried, became loyal Americans, and adopted American politics, including, for some, right-wing extremism. People like Tarrio and Fuentes succumbed to aspirational whiteness and the belief that a secure place in the country's social order requires the repression of those they deem beneath them. Fear of crime has led to a surge of gun buying among Latinos, which can also fuel belief that power comes from guns and violence. Four of the 21 mass shootings in Texas this year were committed by Latinos. The terrible irony is that in a country with rising racial violence, Latinos can be both potential perpetrators and potential victims. The sham of diversity training. It's time to admit the truth about diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI training, said Connor Friedersdorf. Its impact on workers ranges from useless to counterproductive. DEI training at workplaces and schools exploded after the 2020 police murder of George Floyd. A poor black man's death became a pretext to sell hazily defined consulting services to corporations. It grew into a multi-billion dollar industry embraced so quickly that due diligence was skipped and costly failures guaranteed. Obviously, employers should foster cultures where all applicants are welcome, workers are free of discrimination, and everyone is treated with dignity. What many highly paid DEI consultants teach, however, is social justice gobbledygook about white supremacy culture and workplace microaggressions. But hundreds of studies dating back to the 1930s suggest that anti-bias training does not reduce bias alter behavior, or change the workplace. In fact, research indicates DEI training can even backfire, creating resentment and making white employees more hostile to diversity efforts. Still, corporations continue to burn millions of dollars on diversity training to virtue signal their commitment to equality. But don't results matter more than intention? This column comes from France. How our xenophobia will hurt us. So much for France's rebirth as Europe's next great powerhouse, said Felipe Ashkenazi. A decade ago, the UN predicted a demographic upheaval in Europe that would see France supplanting Germany as the European Union's most populous country. By 2050, France was supposed to add 10 million people to reach 75 million, while Germany would lose 10 million, leaving it a few million short of France. But the latest projections are spectacularly different. Mainland France is now expected to have a mere 66 million inhabitants, far below Germany's projected 79 million. These opposing trajectories reflect a dizzying political contrast between the two nations. Germany sees migrants as its future. It already takes an average of about 1 million immigrants annually and is wooing even more. French leaders, meanwhile, are relieved that so few Ukrainians have chosen France as a refuge and are doing nothing to encourage new arrivals. It's a recipe for disaster. With birth rates falling, disincentivizing migration will mean a lack of hands to make up the French workforce. Xenophobia is, of course, only to be expected from the French right. What's surprising is that no other political voice is speaking up for the immigrants we so desperately need. And the last word, our feature article, titled this week, The Abandoned Horses of Coal Country. Herds of horses now range over former coal fields in West Virginia and Kentucky, said Ashley Stimson in the Sunday Long Read. But these beautiful animals weren't meant to live in the wild. The horse wasn't just skinny, she was skeletal. Not just thirsty, desperate. Alive, but just barely. When the scrawny filly wandered into Joey Ferris' yard, he knew exactly where she had come from. Ferris was a lieutenant at the Mingo County Sheriff's Office, where operators frequently fielded calls about horses like this. In addition to putting out food and water, he decided to use the opportunity to call attention to their ongoing plight. He began the video he uploaded to YouTube in 2017 with a matter-of-fact assessment. Bad things are happening in southern West Virginia. People get a horse, Ferris says into the camera, eyebrows furrowed, and they leave the horse on the strip mine. Behind him, the cumin-colored filly bowed toward a pan of water, her amber tail flicking away dogged summer gnats. It had been a few weeks since this one had appeared on his property, he explained. Her ribs were once again beginning to disappear beneath her flesh, but the horse's hip bones strained against her hide like a pair of blunt arrowheads. We've been feeding her really good, but she's still bony. Ferris posted the video to his YouTube channel and called it Abandoned Horses of West Virginia Need Help. The bony brown horse was content to hang out in his backyard for a meal or two, but she bolted at the first sign of a harness. So he forwarded the video to someone who might know what to do. If anyone knew that West Virginia's abandoned horses needed help, it was Tina Creamer, who had been trying to get people to pay attention to the problem for years. Creamer runs Heart of Phoenix, a West Virginia horse rescue about 2 hours north of Ferris' home in the area known as the Southern Coal Fields, where decades of strip mining, removing mountaintops to access the minerals beneath, have turned the undulating topography into flat, grassy prairies ideal for grazing. The consolation prize, for years, locals took advantage of the newly available space. It was an informal system with implicit rules. Round up your horses in the winter, absolutely no stallions. But when the economy tanked in 2008, many in the region could no longer afford to feed their horses. And so they simply left them, even their stallions, on these sites, hopeful they would survive on the grass that mining companies were legally obligated to plant after operations had shut down. Within a decade, thousands of free-roaming horses were scratching out a living on abandoned and active strip mines across 9 counties in eastern Kentucky and 4 in southern West Virginia. When Creamer watched Ferris' video of the filly, who would eventually be named Phoebe, she knew there was a good chance for a rescue. A starving horse 2 weeks from death, Creamer said, but young. Age was greatly on her side. Creamer figured that Phoebe had been rejected by her herd. At some points, perhaps weakened by parasites or too dependent on her mother's milk, she had become a liability. Coyote bait. To drive her away, the other horses kicked her, bit her, or ran her down until the only logical thing for the filly to do was to seclude herself. But the complex social instinct that told Phoebe to hide also compelled her to seek companions. In this case, a miniature pony that belonged to Ferris's girlfriend. Phoebe was looking for a new herd. Visiting Ferris and using that friendly pony as a lure, Creamer enticed Phoebe into a trailer and back to the rescue. A couple weeks after Ferris posted his video, Phoebe was off the mountain for good. Heart of Phoenix is located a few miles north of Huntington, West Virginia, in the town of Lesage. A smattering of houses, a small grocery, and a hot dog stand perched on the banks of the Ohio River. The rescue currently houses about 40 horses, 3 of whom had been removed from strip mines. At 40 years old, Creamer has a mane of dark hair, glassy blue eyes, and a full-throated Appalachian accent that stretches her vowels like taffy. She knows it sounds made up, but swears it's true. Her first word was horsey. Growing up in Lincoln County, West Virginia, Creamer amassed hundreds of Briar horse models. By 11, her mom had enrolled her in riding lessons. By 14, she had a horse of her own. She spent her teenage years at auctions with her horse trader grandfather, who also took her to the Kentucky Derby, where they watched from the infield. Horses were always there, in real life and in the stories her father used to tell, about growing up a starving little boy with no daddy in Lincoln County, where having a horse was a luxury. His voice still caught with emotion when he talked about the family mule that got shot for pilfering a neighbor's garden, leaving his mother with no way to get to town, no way to pull firewood down from the hills. But by adulthood, Creamer had moved on from horses and away from West Virginia. At 24, she was living in Florida with her husband and son, most of a literature degree under her belt, and plans to become a novelist when she had an epiphany. "I love West Virginia. I love it in a crazy, mad, ridiculous way," she says. She missed her dad. She missed her 5 siblings. "I had to get back home." Creamer returned to West Virginia in the waning days of 2006, intending to make a fresh start. Instead, she got there just in time to say goodbye. It was a rainy January night around 11 p.m. when a fire broke out at the 6-story Emmons apartment building in downtown Huntington. Creamer's 19-year-old brother Ben, 17-year-old sister Angel, and 14-year-old brother Quentin were inside. All 3 were killed. 16 years later, Creamer says, the loss is something you don't get over. The first year after her sibling's death, Creamer was a mummy. But the next year, suddenly, she found herself wanting a horse. It was a piece of being a kid. What did I have as a kid? Those siblings and horses. She only wanted one, a horse she could keep on the land she bought outside of town. She turned to Craigslist. It was 2009, a year into the country's worst recession in a generation, and the online classifieds revealed the grisly fallout. You couldn't log on there and not see horses starving to death or being given away everywhere, she said. By 2010, Creamer had founded Heart of Phoenix, which she named after one of her first rescues, a neglected horse whose painful hoof condition made her impossible to save. HOP was still a fledgling nonprofit in 2012 when Creamer learned about horses roaming old strip mines. Someone sent her an email with a picture of a horse that looked like it had been set on fire. The horse was located in Mingo County, the email said. Could she help? When she wrote back asking for the owner's name and address, the person explained that the horse lived on a strip mine. Lots of them did, actually. Even 12 years later, her eyes still get wide recalling the moment. She decided to go see for herself. They were out there, all right. Herds teeming with emaciated horses, some with hides marred by open wounds and lacerations, nosing for something to eat amid rocks and brush, breeding and inbreeding indiscriminately, swarming local roadways to lick salt off the pavement. She knew even the healthy-looking horses were likely vitamin-deficient and full of worms. They're domestic animals. They are in no way designed to live out there, she says. The connection between human and horse was never a mere partnership, not the sort of practical arrangement we shared with donkeys or oxen. We carved them out of marble, wrote classic novels about them. We braided their manes and took them as dance partners, set their likeness on rockers and placed them beside our babies' cribs. Today, these beasts of burden no longer carry actual burdens. Instead, they bear an arguably heavier load. Raw human emotion. Romance, nostalgia, glory. For so-called wild horses, we have reserved our most precious sentiments, those of America itself. But there are more than a few holes in our mythology. First of all, in the United States, there's no such thing as a wild horse, not genetically, because all horses today are descendants of domesticated stock, and not in any literal sense of the word either. For instance, perhaps the country's most famous herd of feral horses, Virginia's Chincoteague ponies, are carefully tended by a local volunteer fire department, using funds raised in an annual auction of the island's foals. The 150 or so horses, made famous by Marguerite Henry's beloved children's book, Misty of Chincoteague, are kept safe from their adoring fans with barbed wire and receive regular year-round veterinary care. On North Carolina's Outer Banks, herds of feral horses are managed by state and federal agencies, as well as a handful of nonprofits. The Coalfields feral horse herds, though, have none of this. As the herds grew, grim stories appeared in local papers. Hungry horses chewing the sides off houses, ripping up landscaping, and causing car accidents. In 2016, three stallions were found shot to death on a decommissioned strip mine in Johnson County, Kentucky. And in 2019, 20 horses were shot in Floyd County, Kentucky, the majority pregnant mares. Suddenly, a new narrative threatened to calcify, one that warped Appalachia's long-held affection for the horses into something negligent, even malicious. So, in recent years, new efforts have emerged to recast the horses into a new role, from ecological crisis to tourist attraction. Locals argued that with a little supplemental care, a salt block here, a hay bale there, not only could they endure, they might actually become a point of pride for the region. something beautiful in a beleaguered place. Kramer, who for years argued against using the horses as tourist attractions, has softened her stance on the issues. "But it's a wonderful life until it isn't," she warns. "There's not a single horse out there that stays in that life. It can look like the most beautiful thing you've ever seen, but next year it could be emaciated, leg broken, hit by a car. And just because a horse looks healthy doesn't mean it is." Kramer says most of the horses HOP has rescued from strip mines were malnourished, full of parasites and decaying teeth. "The land looks lush and green, but it's mostly actually weed," she said. "The water sources are all toxic. They don't like you to say that around here, but they are." Soon after arriving at Heart of Phoenix, Phoebe went from a starving, pathetic horse, weeks from death, to a quirky, curious animal, according to Kramer. A big dork with gigantic ears. She grew until she was 17 hands at the shoulder, about 5 feet 7 inches, a size to match her gigantic ears. After a year in rescue, Phoebe went to stay with Adam Black, a horse trainer outside Columbus, Ohio. For 100 days, he worked to get Phoebe ready for HOP's annual competition and adoption event, the Appalachian Trainer Face-Off. Black says working with feral horses presents unique challenges. "They're hypersensitive to body language, eye contact, how you face them," he explains. "It's that predator-prey mentality. Years of survival have taught them that." Eventually, Phoebe relaxed, her muley long ears softened, and Black could slip a harness over her nose. Then a lead, then a saddle, then a rider. Then a rider with a pistol who shot balloons while Phoebe dashed confidently. She met dogs and cattle and kids and went for long trail rides at crowded parks. Phoebe finished third at the event and was adopted by Lisa Quinlan, a 57-year-old bookkeeper, a longtime horse owner who lives outside Akron. Among Quinlan's other two horses, Phoebe asserted her dominance. The mare, once rejected by her band, is now the top-notch girl in the field, the head horse. When she sees her owner at the fence line, Phoebe lets out a contented whinny. "She really likes us," Quinlan says with a smile that comes through the phone. "She wants us to be a part of her herd." 5 years after she wandered into a Good Samaritan's backyard, Phoebe has exactly what she came down the mountain to find. But thousands more just like her remain. This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in the Sunday Long Read. We'll read a couple of the health and science short pieces this week, starting with harvesting energy from the air. In a potentially groundbreaking discovery, scientists have found a way to generate clean, renewable energy from the humidity in air. Just as the water droplets in a cloud can produce a lightning bolt, the air-powered generator, or air gen, uses ambient moisture to generate electricity. The air gen is a thin, fingernail-sized film dotted with tiny holes called nanopores, each with a diameter of less than a thousandth the width of a hair. When water in the air passes through the holes, it creates an electrical charge imbalance between the two sides, effectively forming a tiny, constantly running battery. The air gen generates only enough energy to power a tiny pixel on a screen, but researchers hope to magnify that power by stacking them together. Senior author June Yao from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst estimates that a billion of the devices, taking up about the space of a refrigerator, could partly power a home. Something smaller could be used to generate energy when traveling to remote areas. Imagining having clean electricity available wherever you go, Yao tells the Washington Post. The technology is still at an early stage. Researchers haven't yet worked out how to stack the air gens or store their energy, but its potential is huge. The entire Earth is covered with a thick layer of humidity, he says. This is just the beginning of making use of that. The drug that AI found, pinpointing which chemical compounds can be effective medicines, is arduous and time-consuming, unless you get artificial intelligence to do it. Scientists have for the first time successfully used AI to identify a new treatment for a resistant superbug, reports CNN.com. The researchers trained the program by manually testing thousands of compounds on the bacteria Acinetobacter baumannii and feeding the AI the results. They then provided chemical details of 6,680 other drugs and asked the AI which ones might work as treatments. An hour and a half later, it spewed out a short list. When the researchers tested 240 of the suggested treatments, 9 proved to be potential antibiotics. The most promising was abalsin, which was able to knock out A. baumannii infections in mice without harming other beneficial bacteria nearby. If more antibiotics work that precisely, the researcher said, bacteria might not become drug resistant in the first place. It's incredibly promising, said Cesar de la Fuente at the University of Pennsylvania, who wasn't involved in the research. Drug discovery is sort of the next frontier. We'll move on to the talking points page, starting with the article. Christie on a mission to take down Trump. The Republican presidential primary race is finally getting a brawler in the mix. A former New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. So far, Donald Trump's rivals have been afraid to criticize him too harshly, lest they alienate his supporters, and are merely giving the former president a passive-aggressive side-eye. But Christie, who announced his candidacy this week, could change the dynamic of the race if he goes all in on his no-nonsense, in-your-face, Jersey tough guy shtick, the one where he yells at people to sit down and shut up. In 2016, Christie endorsed Trump after his own presidential campaign failed. But he sharply rebuked Trump after January 6 for refusing to accept the 2020 election results, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. The former federal prosecutor has the verbal skills and chutzpah to do real damage. As a former Trump supporter, he can argue that Trump has disqualified himself with serious crimes and can help to create a rationale that allows Republicans who voted for Trump to move on. Christie's mission is a noble one, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. A third Trump nomination would mark the end of the Republican Party as a vehicle of conservative thought and a complete transformation into a doomed Trump forever personality cult. Christie is almost Trump's equal in showbiz and is superior in invective, a real political talent and street fighter who won't be cowed by Trump's bully act. Christie has very little chance of winning the nomination, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. But having endured so many ups and downs in his own career, his final political act may be self-sacrifice. He's rhetorically and temperamentally equipped to prosecute the political case against Trump, but it would likely be a kamikaze mission. In knocking out Trump, he'd likely make room for another candidate to surge to the fore. And the Republican field is growing. This week, former Vice President Mike Pence joined a group that already included Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley. Ironically, someone else, most likely DeSantis, would probably benefit electoral from Christie's sacrifice. Still, with Christie's entry into the race, we're on the cusp of someone actually running against Donald Trump. Imagine that. Manchin, why a pipeline is in the debt deal. Senator Joe Manchin sure knows how to get his way, said Heather Sauvoyne Horn in the New Republic. With President Biden desperate to pass a deal to avert default on the national debt, the West Virginia Democrat was able to use his crucial swing vote to advance his pet project, a 304-mile natural gas pipeline through his state into Virginia. Never mind that the Mountain Valley Pipeline is a bad project that has incurred more than 500 regulatory violations over the 6 years of its construction. Never mind that it has nothing to do with the debt ceiling. Manchin insisted on it, so it's now on a fast track for approval. The many lawsuits filed against this pipeline aren't nuisance challenges, said the Charleston, West Virginia Gazette-Mail in an editorial, but red flags willfully ignored. Its route is vulnerable to landslides, and landowners in its path have legitimate fears about its harm to the environment, particularly to their water quality. The government is sweeping aside all those concerns. Manchin owes Republicans a big thank you for liberating the pipeline from green purgatory, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. He had struck a bargain with Democrats last year to support Biden's big climate bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, in exchange for a bill to fast-track the pipeline. The Democrats never delivered. Instead, it is the Republicans who allowed him to fold his project into the debt ceiling deal. It's not the worst trade-off, said Robinson Meyer in Heat Map. The pipeline will increase U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by perhaps 16 million metric tons a year, with the highest estimate coming in at 89 million tons. The climate package, by contrast, will save the country some 660 million tons a year by 2030. Though it would be better not to have to make such a choice, Manchin's deal still produces a net climate benefit. Yet it sets a dangerous precedent, said Jonathan Mingle in the New York Times. The Manchin carve-out compels federal agencies to approve the pipeline's permits and then shields those permits from judicial review. So the West Virginia and Virginia residents harmed won't get their day in court. Expect more such side deals for the fossil fuel industry and its backers. After all, there will always be a political crisis that seems more pressing than the someday apocalypse of global warming. This is what it looks like to shuffle along toward climate chaos. One misguided compromise at a time. And we'll read some of the shorter notes. The 2022 election brought 39 states under single-party control, with the same party in the majority in both legislative chambers and the governorship, the highest number in at least three decades. Republicans have total control of 22 states, Democrats of 17. A nationwide shortage of lifeguards will keep thousands of pools across the U.S. closed this summer or operating with reduced hours. Around a third of the nation's more than 309,000 public schools are affected by the shortage, which began during the pandemic, when many lifeguards found new jobs and certification classes for new guards were canceled. Lifeguard-strapped cities are raising pay, offering signing bonuses, and instituting new training programs. Only about 350 American students studied abroad in China this academic year, down from as many as 100,000 a decade ago. Some 300,000 Chinese students study here this school year. Florida would lose 10% of its workforce and about $12.6 billion of its GDP if it expelled all its undocumented workers, according to the Florida Policy Institute, a left-leaning policy research organization. A new state law that takes effect July 1st will force employers to verify the work eligibility status of their employees with a federal database. On the poll watch, 62% of Americans say Trump should not be allowed to serve as president if he is convicted of a serious crime, while 23% think he should be permitted. Among potential GOP primary voters, 46% would support him even if convicted of a serious crime, while 37% say they would not. And we have time for two of the quotes today, starting with one from Martin Amis, who says, "Seriousness and morality and indeed sanity cannot exist without humor." And speaking of humor, Wanda Sykes says, "Until a drag queen walks into a school and beats 8 kids to death with a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird, I think we're focusing on the wrong shit." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.